to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet, the Messenger of Allah. Imam al-Jawad was also the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, and his eminence undertook the imamat and the religious leadership of the Muslims after his father's death, the martyrdom of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam. As historians have unanimously agreed, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was not more than 7 years old when he undertook the imamat and the religious leadership of the Muslims. Now, this great role of the imamat and the religious and spiritual and political leadership of the Muslims, of course, would not befit a keeper who had the mentality of a child and who was only a mere 7 years old. Because if one is to plunge into the fields of knowledge and wisdom, or enter into any kind of debate or controversies, especially so with great scholars and specialists, the amount of knowledge and wisdom needed must surpass that of even a very aged person. But we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, despite being not more than 7 years old, broke this notion and showed the world that though he was still a child, but because he was a divinely appointed imam on behalf of Allah, he was able to enter the fields of knowledge and wisdom and win in the debates and controversies against great scholars and specialists.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, the ninth divinely appointed Imam. It is unfortunate, but it is also the reality that amongst the divinely appointed Imams, we find that during the later Imams, for example, from Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam forwards, except for Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, there is less and less things that are known about the divinely appointed Imams. So, for example, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. These are all Imams whom we have relatively lesser amount of knowledge as regards to them. Of course, because these were the Imams that were also under strict surveillance, under severe repression and oppression, and of course the companions of these divinely appointed Imams and Immaculate Imams were also under severe pressure and severe oppression. But what we do have from these divinely appointed Imams really is very, very beautiful. Yeah, it does make us feel like how we wish we had so much more at hand from these beautiful Imams. It would be able to bless our lives so much more. But even that which we do have is truly a treasure trove of divine guidance and divine wisdom. In one of these conversations that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam has with his companions, in this dialogue they are talking about the reality and the definition, if you will, about good manners. And so in this conversation at one point we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam talking about good manners, he says that one who misses good manners, meaning one who doesn't have good manners, or one who lacks in good manners, the means will fail him. Now, of course, these means that will end to a good result. So, for example, you might have a lot of means to attain something, a lot of perhaps intermediaries or a lot of connections. But these means will fail you if you don't have good manners. So, for example, if you're not friendly, if you're not kind, if you're not respectful, and things like these, then what is going to end up happening is that even if you do have means, they're not going to avail you. Why? Because your bad manners and your, your bad manners and your bad behavior is going to get in the way of those means being able to do what they are supposed to do. And so a very interesting, you know, take on good manners, this idea that having good manners will take you quite far, but on the other hand, having bad manners is not going to take you very far. Matter of fact, it's going to keep you retrogressive and it's going to keep you backwards and it's not going to allow you to move forwards, of course, because people do not like individuals who have bad manners. So inshallah, we will all try to have good manners, not just because it helps us to attain our goal, but also it is the righteous, the virtuous, and the noble thing to do. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarat Texts of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ayyuha an-nur as-safi. السلام عليك أيها البدر الطالب السلام
Peace be upon you, O shining light. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones.
Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Abba Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The regime has carried out yet another airstrike in Syria, this time targeting positions in the western city of Homs. A war monitoring group said explosions rocked the city and fire broke out in a research center. The Syrian military said the country's air defense intercepted several missiles, but the strike injured several soldiers and caused some material damage. The Sunday strike near the city of Homs was Israel's third such attack since last week. The regime carried out two separate attacks near the capital Damascus on Thursday and Friday. Syria was soon to react. In a statement, the Syrian Foreign Ministry slammed what it called fascist Israeli military attacks, saying the regime is in close coordination with terrorist groups to prolong the crisis in the Arab country. Iran's Revolution Guards Corps, which lost two of its members in Friday's attack, warned Israel of a crushing response. In a statement, the IRGC said, quote, "The crimes of the fake and criminal Zionist Israeli regime will not go unanswered, and it will pay." Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani condemned the attack, saying the blood of the high-ranking martyrs will not go waste, and that Tehran reserves its right to respond at the appropriate time and place. This comes as the regime in Tel Aviv argues that it carries out attacks in Syria to prevent Iran's growing presence. Syria, however, says military cooperation and arms program with Iran are part of a decades-old strategic partnership to withstand Israel's long-term threats. Iran says its officers serve as an advisory role in Syria at the invitation of Damascus. Syria has sent numerous letters to the United Nations calling on the world body to intervene and put an end to Israeli attacks, but almost all those calls have fallen on deaf ears. The international community has failed to even blame the Israeli regime for the losses inflicted on Damascus. The latest Israeli airstrikes in Syria's homes is the regime's seventh such attack in March, which is an indication that the regime has been raising the number of its aggressions against Syria. But why is the regime increasing the number of its attacks? First and foremost, what seems to be the case is the fact that the Arab world is increasing its engagement with the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. From Egypt to Saudi Arabia, each country has its own reason to resume relations with Damascus. Egypt has set up contacts with Assad, with both sides having agreed to strengthen cooperation during their first official visit by a Syrian foreign minister to Cairo, which is unprecedented in over a decade. According to Egyptian sources, the visit was aimed at putting in place steps for Syria's return to the Arab League through Egyptian and Saudi mediation. Meanwhile, Riyadh and Damascus have reached an agreement to reopen their embassies after the Muslims' holy month of Ramadan. Saudi Arabia says it is planning to invite Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to an Arab League summit that Riyadh is hosting in May. Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan is set to travel to Damascus soon to hand President Assad a formal invitation to attend the summit scheduled for May 19. From a different perspective, Israel sees its existence in tatters ever since Iran and Saudi Arabia decided to normalize ties. That could significantly be one of the most reasons behind an increase in the number of attacks against Syria. All in all, what seems to be of high significance is that Israel and its longtime ally, the United States, see no other option but to weaken the government in Damascus by any means, be it by pounding Syria with missiles and rockets or maintaining presence in the Arab country to plunder the country's oil riches. All can be considered as the West's attempts to keep Damascus in isolation, something which has so far proven to be otherwise. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed off on a new foreign policy strategy aimed at prioritizing the elimination of what it calls Western dominance in global politics. Addressing members of the Russian Security Council via video link, Putin said,
"Cardinal changes in international life have forced us to seriously adjust key strategic planning documents, including the foreign policy concept of the Russian Federation, which outlines the principles, tasks, priorities of diplomatic activity."
The Russian leader explained that the key document had to be altered due to what he termed as drastic changes in the international landscape. The new foreign policy outlines how Russia could take, quote, symmetrical and asymmetric measures in response to unfriendly actions against it. The 42-page document says to build a multipolar world, Russia would create conditions to counter any neocolonial and hegemonic ambitions. The document was presented by Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who in a televised address said Russia faces existential threats to its security.
"The existential nature of threats to the security and development of our country driven by the actions of unfriendly states is recognized in Russia's new foreign policy."
Lavrov said the United States of America is directly named as the main initiator and conductor of anti-Russia sentiment, and in general, the policy of the West aimed at weakening Russia in every possible way is characterized as a hybrid war of a new kind. He said that anti-Russia measures include undermining its military, economic, and technological potentials, as well as aiming to limit its sovereignty in external and internal politics to erode its territorial integrity. Lavrov underlined that Moscow will no longer rely on the West for energy trade and instead will shift its business toward China and India. The top diplomat's comments came as Moscow has voiced its readiness to maintain its strategic parity and peaceful coexistence with the United States and establish a balance of interest between the two. Nevertheless, the new policy document has made it clear that the prospect of such relations largely depends on the U.S. abandoning its domineering stance and giving emphasis on interactions with Russia. Moscow says it expects Western powers to recognize the futility of confrontational policies and hegemonic ambitions and to eventually return to pragmatic cooperation with Russia. Russia has clearly stressed that mutual respect should be the basis for dialogue and cooperation. Russia's new strategy package has stressed the need for boosting cooperation with China and India. It calls for the deepening of ties and cooperation with friendly, sovereign, global centers of power and development located on the Eurasian continent. Moscow has already stepped up energy supplies to both China and India after being almost entirely cut off from its traditional European markets. However, Russia's new policy document can also be seen in light of Chinese President Xi Jinping's recent visit to Moscow. Undoubtedly, China and Russia share a common concern about the West that has been trying to isolate the two countries from East and West Asia, Europe to Africa under different pretexts. Russia has time and again warned the US-led NATO against its eastward expansion, calling it an existential threat. Ironically, that was one of the reasons of Moscow's military offensive against Ukraine. In West Asia, the US continues to maintain its presence by deploying troops to the countries like Iraq and Syria under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But its military adventurism is to instill fear among regional countries and to serve as a goal to encircle Russia. In East Asia, China has long accused the United States of trying to create what it calls Indo-Pacific NATO by signing a string of defense agreements from the Philippines to Australia. From the military buildup on the Korean Peninsula to providing military assistance to Taiwan by the US and its allies, it seems that Putin's argument about the West's attempt to create a global axis is closer to reality. Instances like China brokered diplomatic rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as well as Russia move to stop the West's expansionism, are enough to suggest the need of a multipolar world order. This is something countries were deprived of due to the US intentions to make a unipolar world to pursue its own agenda. But a change is taking place given that many countries like Russia, China, and India have proved themselves to be able to shift the global order.
Donald Trump has become the first former United States president to be charged with a crime. A grand jury in New York has indicted Trump after a years-long probe into his alleged role in covering up a hush money payment to an adult entertainer ahead of the 2016 presidential election. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, an indictment is the process when a person receives a formal notice that it is believed that they committed a crime and informs the person of the charges against them. It takes place after a grand jury examines all potential evidence to decide whether a crime was committed. If the jury decides there is enough evidence, an indictment will come. In this case, the grand jury in New York City, which has been meeting since January, indicted Trump after hearing testimony from a number of witnesses. The specific charges are not yet known, as the indictment remains under seal. Trump is expected to be arraigned on Tuesday. After months of hearing evidence concerning a $130,000 payment to adult entertainer Stormy Daniels before the 2016 presidential campaign, the grand jury voted to charge Trump. The money was reportedly meant to buy her silence about the encounter she says they had years before. Trump's former personal lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, has said he coordinated with Trump on the payments to Daniels and to a second woman, Karen Dougal. The former president has denied the affair and any wrongdoing. He said the payment was to protect his reputation from a false accusation. While the particular allegations were not disclosed, multiple U.S. media sites speculated prior to Thursday's indictment that the probable charges pertain to Trump's reimbursement of Cohen, with prosecutors charging that he falsely labeled the payments as legal expenditures. The accusation, which is ordinarily a misdemeanor, could be elevated to a felony if prosecutors link the payment to violations of election law, which limits individual payments to political candidates to $2,700 and requires them to be made public. The payment to Daniels right before the 2016 vote could be considered an illegal campaign contribution. Trump also faces felony investigations related to the 2020 election and over the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol by his supporters. Trump has rejected Daniels' claim, and his lawyer has accused her of extortion. calling himself a completely innocent person, Trump described the indictment as the latest in a series of steps aimed at destroying his Make America Great Again movement. The former president also accused the Democrats who conducted the probe, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, of trying to hurt his electoral chances. Trump has denied any wrongdoing, describing the measure as political persecution and election interference at the highest level in history. A judge is anticipated to unseal the Manhattan charges in the coming days, and Trump will be required to turn himself in to authorities. He will then appear in front of a judge and be formally charged, after which a decision will be made as to whether he should be freed on bond or taken into custody. Legal experts say that any potential trial is still at least more than a year away, raising the possibility that the former U.S. president could face a jury in a Manhattan courtroom during or even after the 2024 presidential campaign as he seeks a return to the White House. After his indictment, Trump's supporters gathered outside his Palm Beach Mar-a-Lago property in Florida to show their support for the former president.
It's totally, you've heard a witch hunt. It's not going to stop here. We've got to continue fighting for Trump because they're going to continue going after Trump because they know he can beat any Democrat they put out there. So they're going to play dirty. They're going to do all the games they can play to get rid of Trump.
Meanwhile, Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who is thought to be strongly considering a 2024 presidential run, called the indictment an un-American move. In a tweet, he said the weaponization of the legal system to advance a political agenda turns the rule of law on its head. He also said Florida will not assist in an extradition request. In reaction to the indictment, Trump's former Vice President Mike Pence said in an interview that the indictment is an outrage.
Well, I think the unprecedented indictment of a former president of the United States on a campaign finance issue is an outrage. And it appears to millions of Americans to be nothing more than a political prosecution that's driven by a prosecutor who literally ran for office on a pledge to indict the former president.
Also, Trump's former United Nations ambassador and candidate for the Republican nomination, Nikki Haley, said in an interview that the indictment was more a political move than a search for justice.
You know, from everything I've seen from this New York district attorney is that this would be something he'd be doing for political points. And I think what we know is when you get into political prosecutions like this, it's more about revenge than it is about justice. And, you know, I think the country would be better off talking about things that the American public cares about than to sit there and have to deal with some revenge by some political people in New York.
Political analysts say that the indictment would put Trump in the spotlight once more and could potentially boost his election chances by focusing all the public attention back on the former president. They say Trump will try to turn his indictment to his advantage by stoking anger among core supporters over what they see as the weaponization of the justice system. Hundreds of thousands of people across France took part in protests and strikes to voice their discontent with Emmanuel Macron's use of constitutional executive powers to push through an unpopular raise of the pension age. Dubbed the Day of Action by French trade unions, Tuesday's protest was the 10th such mobilization since industrial action started in mid-January against the proposed reform, which includes raising retirement age from 62 to 64. A record number of security forces were also deployed across France amid fears of protests turning violent.
Faced with this situation, I have decided to deploy an unprecedented security force of 13,000 police officers and gendarmes, including 5,500 in Paris. 90 units of mobile forces will be deployed, a level of mobilization like never before.
As protesters staged generally peaceful marches across the country, violent clashes broke out in some areas, with security forces using indiscriminate force, including tear gas cannons and water cannons to suppress protesters calling for Macron's ouster. The crisis has intensified due to controversy over policing tactics, with lawyers complaining about arbitrary arrests, injuries, and extreme use of force, fearing crowd control. Over 30 lawyers wrote an open letter to Le Monde on Monday, stating their great concern about what they called arbitrary arrests of hundreds of people. They accused the police of using the judicial system and arrests as a tactic to put people off protesting. Also on Saturday, Europe's leading human rights watchdog accused the French police of using excessive force against protesters. It said people angry at Macron's pension law had the right to protest peacefully and should have been protected from police brutality. Current protests are the most serious challenge to Macron since the Yellow Vest revolt 4 years ago. Polls show two-thirds of French people are against Macron's pension reform and the decision to push it through without a parliamentary vote. Called on the government to suspend the controversial pension bill, suggesting the use of outside mediators to reach a consensus and end the chaotic situation in the country. But the government turned down the idea, saying the cabinet is willing to discuss other policy changes, but not to review the pension bill.
They refuse mediation with us. They refuse to discuss pensions. And you want me to tell you what the compromise would be? There is no compromise for the moment. The compromise is that the government doesn't even want to discuss pensions with us, while for the 10th time we have a day of mobilization, which is extremely well attended.
We have a government which has decided not to listen to the voice of society and decided to ignore the problems of the French people. So we said to ourselves, what is our future in a society like this, with a government that despises the voice of the young people?
Nearly 2 weeks after Macron forced a new pension law through parliament using a special provision, unions have vowed no let-up in mass protests to get the government to back down.
We are going to continue the mobilizations. Today we are fighting for it to be really withdrawn, for this reform to be withdrawn. So if we can't go towards a pause and towards a mediation to discuss this reform again, we will continue the mobilizations and we will wait for the Constitutional Council to give us reason.
Public frustration at the French president's reform plans have evolved into broader anti-Macron sentiment.
We still see today in the polls that the French remain determined and are very largely in the majority. And it's Emmanuel Macron today who is losing popularity and not the social movement.
The protest movement against the pension reform has turned into the biggest domestic crisis of Macron's second mandate, with his approval rating at just 30%. Macron says the bill will come into force by the end of the year, arguing that the changes are necessary to prevent the pension system from collapse. But opponents say the overhaul is extremely unfair.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about, in fact, some of the rules related to fasting and Ramadan, since we are in the month of mercy, in the month of barakah, and in the month of Ramadan. So we're going to deal with this, in fact, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about the very important topic of fasting and some of the jurisprudential laws about fasting and Ramadan based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei in this program. Sheikh Javed, you know, we know, you know, some people are addicted to smoking, kind of, you know, and they find it pretty hard actually to quit.
Yes.
And when it comes to Ramadan, they become irritated very much. And some of them cannot abstain from the smoking conduct, this conduct. And this, in fact, disturbs the peace and quiet of the family. All right?
Yes.
And, you know, they become very nervous as a result. So what's their duty in this scenario, in this situation?
Well, according to most religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may he live long, smoking is not permissible as an obligatory precaution in the month of Ramadan. So the religious authorities, unlike some few religious authorities who have clearly and explicitly forbidden smoking, some religious authorities, like Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, have exercised precaution, saying that based on obligatory precaution or ihtiyati wajib, it is not permissible to smoke during fasting. And when it comes to, of course, to the fast itself, the fast is affected by smoking as a measure of obligatory precaution. Therefore, no matter whether a person is a chain smoker or someone who is addicted to smoking, fasting is obviously obligatory for him in the month of Ramadan, and he should fast. And of course, he should not. And this state of nervousness, as you mentioned, should not be a license for treating other people harshly without justification, to be kind of ill-tempered, mm-hmm. you know. Actually, the month of Ramadan is a month in which one has to exercise self-restraint, self-control, and he has to control his temper, and he has to devour, actually, his anger. And this is a month in which one has to build himself and improve his resistance and his willpower. And of course, this is where a person should exercise his resilience and his determination not to let his anger on other people or to be ill-tempered or to treat other people harshly and violently.
Mm-hmm, I see. Sheikh Javed, is fasting obligatory for pregnant women? You know, especially for those women, who do not know whether fasting will be harmful for their body and their baby. So what do they have to do?
It depends from one woman to another woman and from one situation to another. And a pregnant woman should look at herself. If she has the stamina or the strength to maintain fast, and there is no likelihood that fasting will harm herself or her baby, then she should fast. In the event that she has reasonable grounds to fear that fasting would actually harm her or harm her baby, then it is not obligatory for her to fast, and she can break her fast. But in the event, of course, if, for example, she ends up having abortion or some other complications, she must, because it was probably the fast that led to it, then she must obviously give the qadha and also a penalty.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay. Thank you very much, Javed. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/Ian. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, Ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mahajad, the host in this program, Asha Tawid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the month of Ramadan and some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, I'm going to present a scenario for you for a pregnant woman who has fasted before, all right? And then I'll give you a series of questions related to that scenario. Then I would appreciate it if you give me the answers.
Sure.
About this pregnant woman who has fasted, all right? But after fasting, she delivered after the whole month of Ramadan. She has delivered the baby, and the baby was found dead. So there was this miscarriage. From the beginning, she had thought that her fasting might be harmful. All right? But
yes,
she fasted anyway, nevertheless. So number one, the question is, was her fasting valid? Number two, is she liable to pay the blood money for the dead baby? Three, what's the jurisprudential law about her case? If she didn't know, if she didn't think that fasting would be harmful, but later found out to be otherwise?
If she fasted even after she had reasonable fears that fasting would be harmful to her, mm-hmm, or her baby, or she discovered later that fasting was harmful to herself or her baby, then of course her fast is invalid, because she went against her the reasonable fear. And we know it from the very beginning, and based on the teachings of the religious authorities and the fatwa, that if one has genuine and real reasonable fear that fasting might cause harm or might be harmful to her, then fasting is basically forbidden. So in this event, since she had reasonable fear and she went against it and fasted, and at the end of the day she realized fasting was harmful to her. So in this case, of course, her fast is invalid, and she has to perform the qadha, of course. But the liability of paying the blood money, when it comes to the paying the blood money, because the child died and she delivered a child which was dead, of course, and the liability when it comes to the blood money, it depends on proving that her fasting caused the death of the fetus, mm-hmm, her fasting. And it is very difficult to prove that it was her fasting that caused the death. Probably there could be some other health complications. It depends on the diagnosis and the decision made by, let's say, by doctors or medical experts.
Mm-hmm. Upon delivery, somebody said, Sheikh Tawi, that God Almighty blessed me with a son. All right?
Yeah.
Who's being breastfed now. In the blessed month of Ramadan, that is approaching, and at present, she said that I'm capable of fasting. However, if I last, my milk will dry up, as mm-hmm, I have a weak constitution. All right?
Yes.
And my baby wants milk every 10 minutes or every hour. So what should I do?
I think that the same question which we discussed or which we gave to your previous question, the same answer, is applicable here. If there is fear of harm, genuine fear of harm to the woman's baby, mm-hmm, due to a decrease in the quantity of the milk or because of its drying up, you know, So the fast is not necessary. It's not recommended. In fact, the woman should break her fast because taking care of the baby is more important. It is actually wajib. It's obligatory for her to breastfeed the child. And if there's no milk, probably the child's health will definitely be affected. So in this case, she shouldn't fast. And for every day, actually, the missed fast, because she's not supposed to fast, the woman has to give one mud of foodstuff, which is, of course, we have time and again said that one mud of foodstuff is equal to 750 grams of food, which must be given for each day to the poor people. And of course, and at the end of the day, after the month of Ramadan, she has to perform the qada as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sawit. Thank you very much for your nice contribution to the program. Is Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me and the rest of the crew. We say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to British media, the recent protests and strikes of civil servants across the United Kingdom has damaged Britain's economy. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Passport office workers went on strike for 5 weeks in an escalation of a dispute over jobs, pay and working conditions. More than 1,000 members of the Public and Commercial Services, or PCS, union working in passport offices in England, Scotland and Wales are taking part in the action from 3rd of April through to 5th of May. Those working in Durham, Glasgow, Liverpool, London, Newport, Peterborough and Southport went on strike from 3rd of April to 5th of May, while those in Belfast who do so from 7th of April to 5th of May. The PCS union said the action was a significant escalation of its long-running dispute, warning it was likely to have a significant impact on the delivery of passports as the summer holidays approach. The Public and Commercial Services Union General Secretary Mark Sawatka said This escalation of our action has come about because, in sharp contrast with other parts of the public sector, ministers have failed to hold any meaningful talks with us, despite two massive strikes and sustained targeted action lasting 6 months. Mark Sawatka added, the approach is further evidence they're treating their own workforce worse than anyone else. They've had 6 months to resolve this dispute, but for 6 months have refused to improve their 2% imposed pay rise and failed to address our members' other issues of concern. They seem to think that if they ignore our members, they'll go away. But how can our members ignore the cost of living crisis when 40,000 civil servants are using food banks and 45,000 of them are claiming the benefits they administer themselves? Mark Sawatka added, it's a national scandal and a stain on this government's reputation that so many of its own workforce are living in poverty. The industrial action proposed by passport office workers comes after months of strikes over pay in other sectors of Britain's economy, such as rail, the London Underground, schools, regional BBC journalism, and in Britain's universities. Mike Clancy, the General Secretary of Prospect, thousands of whose civil service members went on strike recently, said there was a sense that the government's own workers were often at the back of the queue when it came to pay deals, and he urged ministers to arrange talks to end industrial action as early as possible in the coming days. He said the government should now be looking to make sure the format of its pay deal with the National Health Service will read across to its own employers in the civil service. Mike Clancy told The Guardian, there is a recognition in the National Health Service terms that 2022-2023 was exceptional and has to still be addressed, and that 2023-2024 is still a very difficult year, even if there is government hope that there will be a drop in inflation. There has to be a similar structure, and we will then talk about the amounts, adding, what I can't say is that I've got an invite to talks and we have been complaining in public about the failure of the government to respond in this way for its own civil servants. But what has been pretty clear is that overall mood music is that the government would want to sort the NHS first, and I think the teaching unions are having conversations. Mike Clancy added, I really now expect an invite from the government to talk about its own employees, and that better be as early as possible next week. What we have to judge is whether there is sufficient for us to enter discussions and take a view on what we do in terms of our own industrial action. Website news.cgtn.com has also covered this story and tells us more. The security staff of UK's Heathrow Airport have launched a 10-day strike, joining other civil servants and workforces across the United Kingdom industries to walk out of their jobs in a demand for higher wages in the face of skyrocketing inflation. Around 1,400 security guards participated in the strike action beginning on Friday 31st of March after the last-minute talks with the government officials over pay rise failed. According to the union Unite, the industrial action involves staff at Terminal 5 of Heathrow Airport, which is used exclusively by British Airways, and those responsible for checking the imported cargo to the airport. The strike has resulted in British Airways cancelling around 5% of its flights during the Easter period, and 70 flights on Friday only, with the airport warning that some passengers may face security delays over the strike days. The airport was forced to deploy 1,000 extra staff members to compensate the dilemma and to assist passengers on Friday, 31st of March. The aviation industry is under pressure from